Hey, really quick before we start the show, the How I Built This book is now a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. So thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support of this show. If you haven't picked it up and you want to learn the secrets of how to develop an entrepreneurial mindset, How I Built This, the book is for you. It's now available wherever books are sold and in most countries around the world, or by visiting howibuiltthis.com or GuyRaz.com. And thanks.
We did have to go to vineyards and find grapes that were available. And then we also needed to find a facility where we could make our wines. And we also needed to get licensed to do so.
Yes.
And then we also needed to get national distribution ourselves. Like, there was an immense...
In 6 months. You had to do all this in 6 months.
I mean, we had to do that really in like 90 days.
Sounds absolutely terrifying.
Exciting.
Exciting, yes.
It was very exciting.
Thrilling.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how two sisters took their life savings, taught themselves winemaking, and shook up an industry with a brand designed for a whole new type of wine drinker and called it the McBride Sisters Collection. Okay, so I warned you last time. This story is epic, right? And I am assuming you're here because you've already heard part one of this two-part story, how two half-sisters who didn't know the other existed until both were grown up went on to launch one of the biggest black-owned wine companies in the world. But if you haven't heard part one, please stop listening right now and go back one episode in your podcast queue to hear it. As for the rest of you, you've now had a few days to dry your eyes and recover from the first half of the story, which means we are at the business building part of what would eventually become the McBride Sisters Collection. Now, the thing about Andrea and Robin McBride is that despite both growing up in winemaking regions, Robin in Monterey, California, Andrea in New Zealand, neither sister had any real connection to the industry, and neither had any real money to put towards a business. They were also young women of color trying to break into an industry that's often been dominated by older, mainly white men. But none of this mattered. They didn't care. They knew that they both shared a love of wine and that they both had a deep and powerful desire to work together. And there was one other thing. They were motivated by a mission. They wanted to build a company that would make wine more accessible, to disrupt and demystify the sometimes intimidating parts of wine culture. Grape varietals, how to taste it, regional nuances, ratings, even how to read labels. And when they first dreamed up the idea of starting a wine company, Robin, the older sister, had been working at a corporate job and was married with three children. And Andrea was a college student at USC. I mean, neither of you had a whole lot of startup cash, if any. I mean, did you, Robin, did you, I mean, you had been working, but you also had a family. Did you have any savings?
I mean, not much. You know, it was kind of a nearly paycheck to paycheck situation. You know, I had gotten married. We had recently purchased a home, but, you know, we have brand new twin babies and an older girl, so there wasn't a whole lot of cash available.
And Andrea, I'm assuming, given that you were on scholarship at USC and a college student, you probably were broke, right?
Yeah, I mean, I got my scholarship checks, you know, and where you could get a job and, you know, make money, you know, that was what I did.
So the original idea was, it sounds like what you guys settled on was, let's just import wine and kind of put a label on it? Was that the initial idea?
So we had this grand vision. We felt like what was really critically important was that we're incredibly passionate about wine.
Yeah.
We're students of wine, but we need to learn the business of wine. And, you know, we could get this license in California a federal importer's license that was like $1,500. It was like our total life savings. And we could import other people's wines. And we started by reaching out to families in New Zealand. And then we could learn the business. And we went to them and basically said, you know, don't put all your eggs in our basket, but we think California could be a great market to grow your brands and your wines. And we negotiated really long payment terms so we could bring in the wine, sell it, collect the cash, pay the light bill, and then pay them back. And then as a part of like the process was every harvest, we come back and you guys teach us how to make wine.
And you, Andre, had obviously some connections in New Zealand because you're from there and your family, you have family of farmers.
Yeah.
So when you first approached these wineries in New Zealand and they agreed to send you wine, how did that work? Like how many bottles of wine did you initially buy? And then where did you go to sell them?
So it was crazy. It was, at the time, it felt like it was an insanely huge amount of wine. And it was a pallet, which is
like 54 cases,
which is right, like the minimum of what you can like put on a boat, you know. But for us, that was just an insane, and in a case of wine, there's 12 bottles. So
right,
it just felt like a huge feat to be able to get these licenses because, you know, the sale of alcohol in the United States is highly regulated.
Yeah.
And it's very strict. And so just the process of obtaining a license to import seemed and felt like such a huge, rigorous process. And then to convince people, you know, to entrust in us and give us product and then to get it on a boat.
Yeah.
And then bring it into the port of Long Beach at the time and then put it into a federally bonded warehouse because you can't just like bring that to your house. It has to go into a bonded warehouse.
Oh my God.
And then at the point like, wow, okay, it's here. So we got to go sell it.
Yeah.
You know, and then literally Googling, you know, top restaurants in LA and in San Francisco and getting some samples from the warehouse and putting them in a bag and literally just walking into restaurants.
All right, so tell me how you did that. Like, would the two of you go or would you go separately?
So here's what we did. So specifically so at the time, Andrea is still in Los Angeles. I'm in Northern California.
Still at USC.
Yes.
Barely 21 at that point, I think. Like 22, maybe 21.
Yeah, barely legal. So so what we did, and you know, thank God we were so optimistic and so naive. And in a sense, that's kind of what saved our butts from a huge failed launch. Huh. Was that, you know, we didn't play by the rules because we didn't know what they were. Right. And because we didn't play by the rules, we actually, you know, unknowingly gave ourselves some tremendous access to really great accounts. Because we, you know, we had a whole lot of confidence and no business experience. So we were doing all the wrong things. But what we would do is I would sit up in Northern California and, you know, Google like top 10, you know, highest rated, you know, restaurants in Los Angeles. And then I would just like the most naive, like dummy person in the world, pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And I would see who was the wine buyer or the sommelier or the wine director or whatever was going on in that restaurant, you know, just really stalk them and be really creepy. And then I would find the phone number for them. And then I would just cold call. And I don't mean like one time. I mean, I would keep calling until I got to that person. And I don't even know what you're supposed to say in those situations, but I would just say like, hi, you know, this is Robin McBride. I have this amazing wine from New Zealand. I think you're going to love it. It's going to, you know, be blah, blah, blah. Like, when can we come in? And, you know, knowing what I know now, that's ridiculous. But at the time, I think people were just sort of set aback. Like, are you serious? You're calling me on the phone, you know, talking about this. And I just was really, really persistent.
Yeah.
And so we got an appointment and there was a certain protocol where, you know, your distributor goes in and takes you in and you set appointments and,
right,
you know, this whole thing that you're supposed to do. We just didn't know that that's what you were supposed to do. But you know, they would see us because we were just so persistent because we didn't know we were doing the wrong thing.
Did Andrea, did your, Like, I imagine if you have a French accent and you go and you talk about the French wines you're selling, people kind of just psychologically think of you as maybe legit. Did your New Zealand accent maybe kind of help you out?
No.
No, okay.
because this is the thing with wine, is that it, when you think about the great wine regions historically in the world, there are usually in what we call the old world, which is Europe,
right?
Usually France, and very aristocratic, very formal. There's a process, there's guardrails around who does what. And so when you come from a place of where you just don't know what you don't know, it's startling for people, I think, because I think in their mind, they think, how dare you? Like, the audacity, you know, don't you know how this works in this industry type of sort of approach? And when you think about the wine business on the winemaking side, on the ownership side, even within the higher ranks of distributors, it's mostly older men. So I think what was startling was, and why my accent didn't help me, was because I was so young. I was a woman, and I was a woman of color.
Yeah.
At that time, the wine industry was a very close-knit, closed-off industry with a lot of deep tradition that we respect. But at the same time, not a lot of innovation, not a lot of disruption. And so we looked very foreign in these situations.
What was the first restaurant or client who said, okay, yeah, we'll buy a couple bottles?
I can cite one in San Francisco that was a learning moment for us, but ultimately became, I think, probably our first, really notable account anyway, where I was doing my cold calling routine that I do. And this particular person in this particular restaurant, I called, and he's a sort of famous kind of somm and winemaker that purchases the wine for this big restaurant group in California. And I called, and he was completely incensed. I mean, he yelled at me. He said, "Don't you ever, ever call me during service hours." Now, again, us not knowing what the rules were, I said, "Oh, absolutely. What time might that be, you know, so that I can call you back?" And he just said, before 2 or 3. And I said, "Okay, absolutely. I'll call you tomorrow before 2 or 3. And he was just, like, he screamed at me and he hung up the phone. And I was like, had to Google. I'm like, what is he talking about, service hours? Like, what does this mean? And I was like, oh, that fully makes sense, because a restaurant, you know, begins prepping to begin serving their customers, right? But we had absolutely no experience, right? But whatever. I mean, you know, we don't, you know, see many things as failure. It was like, okay, good. Now we know. So going forward, we will never call these folks during service hours. And that ended up being, it's in San Francisco, the main restaurant is in San Francisco. And that ended up being our first really large, for us at the time, restaurant account that had multiple locations.
But how did you convince him to eventually buy your wine?
Because our wine was amazing, and we don't take no for an answer. So by the time that we called during non-service hours, and we, after I'm not sure how many attempts it took, but we ultimately were able to get in there and show them the wines, which we knew were amazing.
And that was luck. That was luck.
Yeah.
Felt like we'd made it.
We made it.
Here's a question, right? Like, now you're on a wine list with like hundreds of wines. Right. And you're a New Zealand wine competing with like probably rich people who are like going to buy Burgundies or whatever, you know, whatever it is. How do you at that point, how can you get the sommeliers to encourage people to try your wine?
Well, this was a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc that I think was like $24 a glass.
Oh, wow. OK. So it was an expensive wine.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And okay. I think at the time what we had on our side, this was like pre-2008. And New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, I think, for the world wine industry, was this new kid on the block that just exploded. So I think in terms of timing, that was our star, you know, in our portfolio. Yeah. And then we also had some really just beautifully gorgeous wines from New Zealand. And so it was a really great time to be introducing people to something new.
So really, it was the two of you like working the phones and cold calling mm-hmm. and just hustling and probably hearing a lot of no's.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. did those no's ever make you feel bad? Or, I mean, or how were you able to stay unflappable and to just keep pushing forward through those no's?
I think it comes down to, again, sort of what drives us and a little bit of DNA probably also that we might not be able to take credit for. I'm not totally sure. Or maybe it's just the challenges of the backgrounds that we grew up in that were a little resilient, you know? So I don't think we've ever interpreted anything that we've experienced as a failure because it's all part of, you know, a process of finding out what works and what doesn't work. We're always still learning.
Yeah.
And I think also too, it was, our goal was to found a winery. And our mission has always been to transform the wine industry, to lead by example, most importantly, to cultivate community. That's something that we saw that was like really lacking.
Yeah. Did you, how long did it take you to sell that pallet of wine, that first shipment? Do you remember?
I think it took us about 6 months.
Right.
But then within that 6 month period, there were so many learnings that then thereafter the reorders happened a lot quicker and the sell through was a lot quicker.
And presumably your expenses were pretty low because you guys didn't have a physical office, right?
Yes.
And you were just kind of living modestly, like both of you were.
Yeah, but you still got to pay your mortgage and your light.
Got to pay your mortgage, yes.
And your light bill and the rent. And
yeah. It sounds like initially, because New Zealand whites, Sauvignon Blancs, are like considered to be value wines. Obviously, there are premium ones, but generally value wines. But it sounds like initially you were focused on the premium, right? Some more high-end wines, and you were servicing high-end restaurants.
Yeah.
Initially.
Yeah, in the wine industry, premium, I know it's a little bit like it doesn't make a lot of sense, but premium is anything that's over $13 a bottle. So for the most part, most like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is sort of over that threshold.
Right.
And then, you know, super premium, I think, Robin, is it like over $20?
Yeah, that's like ultra right. premium.
Yes, but, yeah. we definitely were in the higher end part of the business. And we're attracted to that because that is sort of the geeky nature of us learning about wine, the intricacies and everything that comes with it. At the same time, seeing very clearly the juxtaposition of a lot of this isn't accessible to everybody. How do you democratize the wine experience? Because it just seems like when you philosophically, like when you think about wine, it's, you know, it's the bond of nature and people and community
yeah.
that's been going on for like 8,000 years. And that communal connection it creates with food and humanity and love and friendship. You know, I feel like, you know, wine is history and it's culture and it's optimism in a glass, and everybody should have access to that, not just a select few.
Yeah.
And we felt like it was a problem, you know, for us to solve that wasn't being addressed anywhere else, which was how can we help more people experience wine in a better way?
Which, I mean, at every level makes sense, including economic sense, because you think about like these really expensive Burgundies, right, from these chateaus in mm-hmm. France, and you know, people will buy, you know, a case of their wine for, you know, they'll get on a list and they'll get their allocation and they'll pay $1,200 for a case and they'll go and sell each bottle for $1,200, right? Mm-hmm. And those right. small winemakers who are producing small amounts of wine for very elite clients, they're not getting rich off the wine.
Mm-mm.
They're not reaching, mm-hmm. and they're reaching a tiny elite group of wine drinkers,
yeah, right.
right? I mean, it makes infinitely more sense to reach a wider audience at a lower price point.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, we were paying very close attention to the different aspects of the winemaking process that translate to quality. And how could we craft these wines in a way in which by the end, once it passes through importation, distribution, retailer, once it gets to the consumer, is still this really, really high-end wine and product that over-delivers in the quality,
yeah.
but isn't going to break the bank.
Right. And the goal eventually, in your minds at least, was one day we are going to have our own, we're going to make our own wine, or were you not quite there yet?
Yeah, I mean, that was the eventual goal, but it was fast-tracked by 2008. And so when the financial crisis happened, you know, the global economic financial crisis, yeah. We had a couple things going on. There was a bumper harvest in New Zealand, so very, very large harvest that created this huge yeah. surplus of wine. All those fantastic restaurants, you know, that had those, the clientele with the large expense accounts, they all dried up. Yep. And, you know, restaurants for the most part make a pretty good revenue off of their alcohol and their wine. So they stopped paying their bills. And Robin and I got to the point where we just said, wow, this is really, really hard. Trying to figure out how we're going to survive this, and came to the conclusion that if we were going to keep on doing this, we should do it for ourselves. And at this time, it was like now or never. And this was a time that we should make the jump and start a wine company.
Naturally.
I love this. You're thinking, hey, you know what? Let's just use this opportunity, this financial crisis, economic crisis, to actually double down on our business and pivot.
Yep.
When you say it, it sounds so crazy, but yeah, that's exactly right. It's like, well, we've got to do something. Yeah. So we're not just going to sit and be overcome by, you know, this crisis that's going on. We have to be strategic in some way. And so we felt like for the amount of effort and energy it was going to take to keep any business afloat right now, it might as well be our own for our own products.
So how are you going to do that? I mean, presumably, there's a glut of wine in New Zealand on the market. Mm-hmm. Was the idea that you would kind of take advantage of that glut and buy up some of that wine and then put your label on it?
Well, we had that problem from the beginning, which, you know, is cash.
Yeah, right.
So for us, it was looking at strategic partnerships. So looking at this problem of there was this excess of New Zealand wine. Everybody in New Zealand wants to be in the US market. How could we partner with an already established wine company that had infrastructure, that had all the things that we couldn't afford to do, and we could find a synergy in them really being like the infrastructure, us making the wine, and then us now having the expertise not only to make the wine, but also to import it, distribute it, and sell it in the U.S. market.
Who did you find? Who did you find to partner with?
The company doesn't exist now, but at the time, they're called the New Zealand Wine Company. And in 2009, Robin and I made our first wine together under the EcoLove brand.
This is the brand that you created with this winemaker.
Yes. Yes.
And just to clarify, you were going to have a role in sourcing the wine, and then this company was going to bottle and distribute it. So did you go down to New Zealand and sample a bunch of different wines that they were making, or was it already made, or how did you decide which one you wanted to?
Yeah, so the 4 years prior, Robin and I had been sharpening our skills, you know, and learning how to make wine. So we were very particular.
You were going back and forth to New Zealand?
Yeah. So we were very particular in knowing exactly from a growing perspective what we wanted, and then from a winemaking perspective, what we wanted the final product to be. In Marlborough, we have the Northern Valley called the Wairau Valley, and then we have the Southern Valley called the Awatere Valley. And the Wairau is the older part of Marlborough, and it's much warmer. And the Awatere Valley in the south is a lot cooler, and it's more exposed. And as a result, in the wines, in the northern part of the region, you get wines that have this more tropical flavor profile, a lot of passion fruit, a lot of gooseberry, and then also peaches and also red grapefruit. Versus the Awatere Valley is jalapeno, tomato stalk. And Robin and I felt very passionately about producing a wine that had a very tropical spectrum of flavor, and that's what we produced.
So you went down there, and you knew what the flavor profile was? And did you literally, like wine producers will literally tell, you know, the vineyard, pick the grapes now, right now. Like, I'm tasting this grape. Please, we want them right now. The sugar levels in the grapes are perfect. Were you doing that at that point or not quite yet?
Absolutely. And this is the thing, like, the most amazing thing, and this is really, really specific to Sauvignon Blanc grapes, but putting a Sauvignon Blanc grape in your mouth, all the flavor just in general when it comes to wine comes from the grape skin. And and putting this grape in your mouth and just tasting like the flavor and the skins gives you a vision of potentially of where it's going to go. Once you harvest, once you pick, once the fermentation process starts, you really don't have a lot of control.
How do you, this is a bit of a digression, but how do you, because when you are going at that time, and you still do it now, but when you're going to a vineyard and you're picking a grape and you're popping it in your mouth, first of all, wine grapes are really sweet, right?
Yes.
The sugar content is much,
super
much
sweet.
Sweeter than table grapes, right? Because you need all that sugar to create the alcohol.
Yeah.
How do you know when it's the right hour or day of the week to pick them? How do you know? Because it's going to taste different.
There's field tests.
Yeah.
There's field tests you can do also.
There's
you
science.
You go and pick some grapes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's chemistry behind
okay.
it.
So it's not just like your palate and the magic of
I mean, I wish. I wish my mouth could properly calculate the bricks in the grapes. But there is a way to go out and to you know, grab a baggie full of grapes and take them back into the lab and measure the sugar contents to see where it's at.
Right. All right, so you partner with this wine, New Zealand wine company, and they bottle this wine. And by the way, how much did you want to sell each bottle for? This is 2008, 2009. What was the idea? What was the price point you wanted to hit?
What was that, 16,
yeah,
14?
Yeah, between 14 and $16.99.
So not super inexpensive, but affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And how much wine did they, how many bottles or cases did they end up producing and shipping to you?
So our first vintage, I think it was 2,000 cases.
It was nearly 3,000 cases.
Okay, yeah. Robin's the keeper of the coin.
Yeah, I'm the keeper of the books. But I think after the first year, it was about 12,000 cases.
And at this point, because it's now you're 2009, you're in the really heat of the financial crisis and really an economy that's slowing down. Were restaurants your target, or now were you shifting to targeting retailers?
Both. So we were still knocking on doors. We were still going to, you know, restaurant accounts that survived. And then we started to, there was a lot more sort of neighborhood wine shops also that were coming around, independent, you know, retailers.
What was, and how many employees did you have at that point in 2009?
Two.
Yeah.
Two.
I mean, me and her by two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then maybe some people like sort of working part time or on contract to help you sell.
Right.
But it was a tiny operation. You were and still primarily in California.
Yes.
In LA, San Francisco.
Yes.
Right. And just literally going to wine shops and wine bars and personally like pitching this wine.
Yep. And I think the biggest breakthrough at that time, somehow somebody tipped us off that at major corporations across the United States, and even within grocery, there was a department called supplier diversity. And the sole function of the supplier diversity director was to identify women and minority-owned businesses to try and help bring them into those grocery stores.
I think it was through Super Value, right?
Yeah,
Super Value was a large grocery chain in the middle of the country, I guess, and they had a supplier diversity director, and we were like, what is that?
What do you do?
Yeah.
The person at the time was a man by the name of Michael Byron, and I remember Robert and I flew into Minneapolis. That's where Super Value was based. I think it might have been like January or February.
January. It was 11 below.
And this is in like 2009, 2010?
10, 11, mm-hmm. Something like that.
Would have been January 2011. And him really like giving us the lay of the land of like grocery retail, like a real education, and then letting us know like that he was there to really help us understand that customer and how we could be successful. And even better was he said, you know, I'm going to help and I'm going to support you, but where else do you want to sell wine? And I said, huh? And he said, yeah, we got a whole network of us. And like the next day, he sent out emails to Target, to Disney, to all the major like Kroger, all the major Fortune 100, you know, companies in America, like getting us a seat at the table.
Wow.
You know, grocery has always been really important to us because we felt like that's where women shop and that's where we wanted to be.
Right. And so Cost Plus World Market wanted to put our wines into their stores nationally. That then, for the first time, took us outside of California.
I mean, I imagine this was a huge, like a huge breakthrough for the business. But I imagine it was still not. You still weren't like, you know,
we weren't rolling in dough. No,
yeah, you weren't rolling in dough. Yeah. Did you? I mean, it's interesting because in between 2009 and 2011, right? Financial crisis, a lot of businesses go under. But I suspect that wine is one of those weird things that does okay, right? Because it's like, it's a small thing that, you know, makes people feel a little bit better and it's a nice little luxury, right? Is that what you saw?
Exactly. It is, I don't want to say it's recession proof because the channels in which you operate definitely play into when a recession hits, for sure, when it comes to the wine industry. But I would say for the most part, you see that consumption lessens out in restaurants and what we call on-premise accounts, but more consumption happens at home.
This is, I mean, you kind of alluded to this earlier, but the whole like wine-making world, and it's changed a lot, of course, but there is this kind of culture, right? It's still, you know, overwhelmingly made and produced by men. Most of those men are white. And did you guys encounter, you know, along the way, winemakers who were dismissive or who were, I don't know, a bit condescending to you? Or did you find more winemakers who were actually generous and really wanted to share what they knew?
I think there's two different sort of sides to this. I feel like for the most part, people on the winemaking side, on the grape growing side, are pretty generous and welcoming in terms of time and information, because at the end of the day, as much control as you hope to have, Mother Earth like dictates what's going to happen. And I definitely feel like there is a community, a really big community aspect to the wine, the growing and the winemaking side of things.
Right, because winemakers don't grow their own grapes. They're grown by farmers who, and people have plots on those, right? And they're
farmers. Yep. And wine is just, I feel like it's one of those, you know, kind of old school mentality, just in the terms of you are open with information and with assistance to your neighboring farm. I think it's a little bit different, however, when you move away from the agricultural side of it and the winemaking side, and you get more into the business side when you're dealing with gatekeepers, when you're dealing with wholesalers, distributors, and retailers, it's very different than the base of the winemaking and agricultural side.
Did you ever come across somebody who you tried to sell wine to and they were just like, ah, it's terrible? Like, it was kind of snobby about it?
Well, there's a lot of really snobby people in wine.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone's ever said to us, at least not to our face, that our wine was terrible. And quite honestly, I don't think anyone would have a reason to, because we work hard to make sure that we don't make terrible wine. But I mean, there's definitely, you know, depending on what part of the wine world you're in, where you're definitely going to face some pretentiousness, you're definitely going to face all of the things that a lot of people really find intimidating and distasteful about wine. And that's lessening, I think, you know, over the years.
Yeah.
But it's been an unfortunate side effect of being in the wine industry.
Yeah, I'm wondering, because I think like right around 2015, you guys entered into another partnership with Diageo, which I think is either the biggest or one of the biggest alcohol beverage companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And again, like you're sourcing the grapes and you're blending the wine, but it's still distributed by Diageo, right?
Right.
And I'm just using this as one example of a partnership you did, which makes sense because then you don't have to go out and raise a bunch of money and they're well capitalized and you can have a partnership. But I mean, and this is a tricky question, okay, because the wine you're producing is your idea. It comes from your minds. It comes from your experience. It comes from your palate. It's your intellectual property. But I'm assuming that when you do a partnership, it doesn't work out that way. Is that right?
It's quite complicated, honestly. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that you can structure those kind of partnerships, whether it's, you know, a marketing and distribution relationship, right, or production or what have you. But at the end of the day, no one is going to have the vision that we have, right? I mean, that's, you know, unique and specific and generated by us for us. So even in the best situation, there's still going to be some element of where a larger company and an entrepreneurial vision is not going to align.
And look, like Robin and I, we're too much. Like we're the most.
We're a lot.
You know, like we don't sleep. Like this is our passion. And then, you know, then when you are partnered with a company where, you know, for a lot of people, you know, they aren't as passionate as you.
They were sleeping on the weekends. Yeah. It was crazy. It was like not, right. How do you do business like that?
And big bureaucracies. There's,
yeah.
You know,
yes.
Right?
And don't get us wrong. Obviously, like it was a short partnership, but we learned so much. You know, we're so grateful that we had that experience. But at the end of the day, we're still scrappy, agile entrepreneurs with a very, very strong vision.
Yeah.
Who we are, like through our rosé colored lenses, the way that we see the wine industry is very, very different. If we were going to bridge this gender gap that happens in the wine industry and make the wine industry more inclusive, then we had to do that by ourselves. Because politically, within these strategic partnerships, it was just too difficult.
Right. And, you know, we had to realize that, you know, this is something that we simply need to do for ourselves.
So what did you do? Like, how were you going to make that happen?
So we went to lunch one day, and this is sort of at the time in which Robin and I are really heavily talking and thinking about, like, our future and, you know, should we stay with Diageo? And then we went to lunch with this buyer, and he said, I get your vision. I see what you guys are trying to do. Have you guys ever considered just breaking off on your own and creating a McBride Sisters, just a completely like McBride Sisters brand?
And your answer was, yes, we have been, of course.
Since 2005.
And what store was this buyer with, by the way?
So it's Kroger. Kroger is the company.
Yeah, yep. He was kind of like, I don't get it. He's like, I don't get it. Why are you guys making, you know, all these things? And quite honestly, it just, you know, we weren't quite sure how much brand equity there was in putting our own name on the label.
But your answer presumably was, if I'm with you, I'd be like, yes, we want to do this, but we don't have money to do this.
Yeah. And so we said, absolutely, like, yes, we want to do it.
I just want to add, like, as any proper entrepreneur, you say yes, and then you go
figure it out,
and you freak out, and you figure it out. You figure out how to make it happen.
When we come back in just a moment, how that lunch with the guy from Kroger turns into a life-changing deal with a nearly impossible deadline. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey everyone, just a quick thanks to our sponsor, WeTransfer, and its set of tools for transforming doubts into ideas. Collect is a mobile app that helps you save, organize, and share inspiration. Paper is a digital notebook that captures your thinking. Paste is a presentation tool to make it easier to present your ideas. And WeTransfer is a modern, simple file transfer tool. The next time you doubt something, Let WeTransfer's set of tools help move your ideas forward. Learn more at toolstomoveideas.com. Thanks also to TD Ameritrade, offering free education for investors. Choose from articles, videos, webcasts, and in-person events to take your trading knowledge to the next level. Visit tdameritrade.com/education.
On the next episode of Louder Than a Riot, the 20-year fight to clear the name of former No Limit rapper Mac Phipps.
Because me and my brother was close. The years that he lost, that's some of the best years of his life he done lost. For me, it just hurts.
Listen now to Louder Than a Riot, the new podcast from NPR Music.
And one more thing. The New York Times best-selling book, How I Built This, is now available. It's a great read and a great gift for anyone looking for ideas, inspiration, wisdom, and encouragement to have the courage to put out an idea into the world. It's filled with tons of stories you haven't heard about how some of the greatest entrepreneurs you know and respect started out at the very bottom. Check out How I Built This, the book, available wherever you buy your books. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So before the break, we heard how Robin and Andrea were about to end their partnership with the multinational company Diageo and launch their own independent wine company. And right around the same time, the sisters had a meeting with a buyer from Kroger who told them he wanted to stock his grocery shelves with McBride Sisters wine. But the question was, could they do that all by themselves?
And this is September of 2016.
Right.
And, you know, he's talking about going on shelf in March of 2017. And at this point, you know, we have no significant, I mean, we're talking about to do this as multi-million dollars to be able to pull this off.
How were you able to do that without going? I mean, I imagine that there may have been investors who were approaching you saying, we want to invest in your business. Am I right?
Hmm.
No.
We wish. No. I mean, you know, you have to remember that in terms of, you know, in investors and investments, you know, Black women are the least funded, you know, of all entrepreneurs. So there was still, you know, sort of a perception of some risk or some uncertainty. You know, Black women aren't seen in this space as, you know, having a history of being successful, if at all, even being present. So no, there weren't people beating down the door to invest in our company.
And basically, this buyer for Kroger says, okay, it's September of 2016. And the buyer says, well, by March of 2017, we want this on our shelves. That's insane.
Yeah, that means it needs to be like shipping to their locations in January and February.
How much wine, by the way, did you have to make for that order?
25,000 cases of wine.
That year, for the first year.
And you didn't even have a brand yet.
Correct.
Correct.
So you've got to get moving. You've got to get this wine made and bottled and a label designed and slapped on that and shipped to you in 6 months.
Yeah.
You sound very relaxed about this. I am really nervous. I am really nervous.
Well, because we're on the other side of it now. So,
yeah.
But basically, Robin and I had to go out to a bunch of people and say, trust us.
In New Zealand and California wineries.
Yep.
All over.
And it was all going to be Sauvignon Blanc?
No. This is four varieties. So this is Sauvignon Blanc, sparkling Brut Rosé from New Zealand, and then a Chardonnay and a red blend from Central Coast of California. And just keep in mind that 90% of the like 10,000 wineries in the United States make less than 5,000 cases a year.
Wow. So, but this is September. So this is like the end of the harvest, right? In California, at least.
It is. It's right in the middle of harvest.
It's harvest in California.
Yeah.
The harvest in New Zealand is the other side of the calendar, right?
Our spring. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have to go to these wineries very quickly and find the wine, the blends, and make this wine and convince them to make this for you and fast.
Yeah, so we had to find what we call components. So we had to identify, you know, wine that was already made, find these components that fit our quality standard, blend up all of these wines at the same time, negotiating contracts with growers for the coming three vintages.
Yeah.
And basically saying to these people, we don't have any money, but we promise that we'll pay you
when we get paid.
And quite honestly, it was even more complex because we did have to go to vineyards and find grapes that were available. And then we also needed to find a facility where we could make our wines. And we also needed to get licensed to do so.
Yes.
And then we also needed to get our domestic winemaking team together. We needed to get our compliance and our operations and distribution team together. We had to get national distribution ourselves. Like there was an immense...
In 6 months. You had to do all this
in six months. Had to do that really in like 90 days.
It sounds absolutely terrifying.
Exciting.
Exciting, yes.
It was very exciting.
Thrilling.
Presumably, you're at this point, like most of those grapes are spoken for. Most of those wine facilities are already, they've already got contracts.
It's called finesse.
Yeah, it's called finesse.
But you had, of course, some relationships already in
we
New
did.
Zealand and California.
Absolutely.
And did you have to beg and plead with some of these people?
Yeah. Absolutely.
But at this point, you know, we had a history. We did have a name for ourselves. We had a track record of success. And we did have, you know, the largest seller of wine at grocery in the United States saying, you know, we want to bring in your product. So that went a long way.
Did you make the deadline?
Yeah.
You did. So by March of 2017, you were shipping, these were being shipped to Kroger.
Oh, it was on the shelves. We started shipping in January. We started shipping January and February, and it was on the shelf across the country by the beginning of March.
Wow.
I will say, though, I think I lost like 40 pounds or 30 or 40 pounds. No, literally, I did.
Because it was crazy, right?
I lost some hair. I lost like 40 pounds, but we made it happen.
And so how did you get the word? How did the word get out about the wines at Kroger? Did they do demos? Did they promote it?
I think, you know, by this time, all of our packaging, even though it's like very simple, we know how most 99% of consumers label shop, you know? And so we were really very particular about building in these quality cues that we knew that if people didn't know anything about us, we knew that our price point was right. We knew that the packaging, the quality was right. The varietals that we chose were very specific to popular varietals from the regions that we grew up.
Yeah.
And that would carry us a really long way.
What did the labels look like?
We created a family crest, of course, because why not, you know? And so the McBride Sisters crest is a combination primarily of two animals. At the top is a peacock. And so this peacock is representative of our father, because he definitely was a cocky gentleman. And then the peacock is sitting on the two letters MS, which is obviously for the McBride Sisters. And then on either sides of the MS are two lionesses. And those lionesses are representative of either of our mothers because they were fearless. You know, they ran the pride. They're out working. They're out bringing home the bacon, you know, taking care of the kids. And so we made our own family crest. And we created this crest in 2005 with the dream, you know, of we're going to have a winery one day. And so it wasn't just created in 17, you know, it was created back then.
And this was the first time you could use it on the bottles.
Yeah.
How did the wine do at Kroger?
Exceptionally well. So in terms of being a new brand, like into the stores, we were the number one new brand in their stores, you know, at the end of 2017.
Wow. 2018, also a turning point. I guess you were... From what I've read, you were invited to be the wine sponsor for the Essence Festival, which is a cultural and music festival in New Orleans.
Yes.
And you decided to produce a wine that is now one of your most famous wines called Black Girl Magic.
Yes.
Tell me the story about that idea and how that came about.
Yeah. So we got invited to host the opening party for Essence Festival. And every year you have 1 million black women descend on New Orleans over a three-day period. And during the day, you know, it's this empowerment sort of daytime conference, and at night a music festival with headliners like Beyonce and Janet Jackson. And that year there was just so much black girl magic going on, from women becoming judges to, from a sports standpoint, from, you know, winning awards in entertainment, that it seemed really obvious the best way to capture and honor not only what was going on in the moment, but paying homage to all of the women that have paved the way for us to get to where we are today. It felt like Black Girl Magic by the McBride Sisters would be something nice and festive, sort of to capture the moment. And then we decided that we wanted to make a Riesling that was, the great Rieslings of the world come from Germany, and also from the Alsace region in France. And so we were trying to bring our new world expression of this, and really elevating and creating a really super high quality off-dry Riesling. And we went to Essence Festival, and, you know, we were setting up for the event and putting the wines out, and it was just mind-boggling. Like, we've never in our lives had people react to a wine label, let alone the wine, like we did at Essence Festival. And Robin and I just looked at each other and we're like, whoa.
We were like, uh-oh, we probably should have made more.
Probably should have made more, and we need to make this into a range.
Yeah.
And most importantly, I think, unfortunately, the wine industry has just really ignored black people when it comes to wine. And so really, we feel like Black Girl Magic is something, a term, obviously, Robin and I don't own. You know, we're stewards of this brand.
Yeah.
And every time there's like a moment for black women in which they can celebrate, whether that's, you know, you got a promotion, you had a baby, you became a judge, you became a ballerina, like whatever it is, like we just wanted to be able to be there to celebrate with her with just like beautiful high quality wines.
Yeah. You're in retailers and you've finally got your own label, and then 2020, the year of crises and misery for so many of us, pandemic hits, and that's the first challenge of this year. Were you guys worried that your business would be hit?
Yeah, absolutely.
We were very worried, and we took really, really quick measures, everything that we could think of to secure our business, to secure, you know, to make sure that we didn't have to let go of any staff. We just reduced expenses. We buckled down, you know, right away over the weekend because it was just too unknown.
And did you see an instant drop in business and revenue?
No. For us, because grocery has always been such an important channel to us, our business wasn't significantly affected as other wineries, unfortunately, that, you know, make 5,000 cases or less. They're heavily dependent on their cellar door. And so one of the things that Robert and I doubled down on at the end of 2019 was really putting together our e-commerce platform and really heavily investing into it, with the goal strategically of slowly building it.
Direct-to-consumer model.
Yeah.
Selling through our website.
Not knowing that there would be a pandemic. I mean, you were just assuming that this would be a small part of your business, this direct model.
Yeah. Okay. We thought that we were just laying the foundation, that we were starting to put the framework together to over time develop that sector of our business. And then, of course, come the pandemic, we were kind of like, to our team who had started that work, we were like, guess what? It's go time. This is now the company's main focus.
And then it also coincided with our children. So with Robin's daughter, who's the oldest, we always said, if you want to join the family business, that's contingent on you need to go out and work somewhere else and identify a void that we have that we don't do well, and then come back and interview for a position and come and fill that void and make the company greater.
Wow.
And she got her degree in communications and digital marketing, and she went out and she worked for digital marketing agencies for 2 or 3 years. And then finally, she said that she thinks she's ready because, you know, like Andrea said, we were always like, when you have something that you can add to the company, let us know. So she felt she had enough expertise.
And here you are in the midst of a crisis where digital marketing skills are pretty crucial, pretty critical.
Yeah. And I can tell you, we would, in term, you know, we had like a shopping cart, you know, in an online platform with some wine for sale. And I didn't even really pay attention to the revenue. I know that sounds awful, but, you know, maybe it would do like $5,000 a week. I just, you know, it was such a small number in comparison.
Something minimal.
To our wholesale business. Hmm. And then she told us, she's like, I'm going to come in, I'm going to put together a strategy, and then I'm going to execute on the strategy. And she's like, and you, auntie, and you, mummy, you know, just need to, like, let me do my thing. I think I'm going to be able to deliver the results and the return on investment that the company needs. And so, you know, of course, we're just like, okay.
Yeah, I was like, I doubt that, but we'll see.
You know, and then really from the time, from the first week that the plan was in place, she took, you know, that revenue from 5,000 to like 30,000. And I was like,
wow.
I was like, whoa, hold on.
The first week to 100,000 to 200,000 to.
And this is like getting the word out through like Instagram and Facebook ads and digital ads and things like that.
Exactly.
Okay, so you've got this direct to consumer model. We're all in this COVID pandemic. You know, you are now finally reaching the customers that you felt were underserved for so long, and then we get to May, June of 2020, mm-hmm. and massive demonstrations yeah. against racial injustice in America, the biggest demonstrations in a generation in the United States. Yeah. And you are, I mean, you're a Black-owned winemaker.
That's right.
And on top of just contending with the challenges of the pandemic, you're now contending with the emotional challenges of watching this all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I think originally it was like, here we go again, and feeling like exhausted and defeated. And in one of those moments where I think for myself, you know, I'm the biggest optimist in the world, but really in that moment, just feeling like, where do we go from here? And I think, you know, we had this opportunity for a light to be shone on Black business owners with Blackout Tuesday. And one of the things Robin and I had been working on since January was at National Grocery, we're the only, mm-hmm. a lot of the times we're the only Black-owned company, we're the only woman-owned company.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we were working on was, you know, we shouldn't be the only one. And so we started to kind of look around and think about how can we help other people get here as well. And then we started yeah. to try and figure out, like, is there a list of Black vintners, you know? And when we talk about Black vintners, we're talking about not just the United States, but in France, in South Africa, yeah. you know, wherever. And we couldn't really find a really good comprehensive list, so we started putting together our own list. And then that night that we found out about Black Tuesday, you know, we called everybody in the company and we said, you know, instead of just talking about ourselves tomorrow, let's shine a light on, you know, Black vintners. This list that we have, it's like 67 Black vintners that we could find, you know, in the world. Like, let's publish this list and shine a light on our community. Sure. And I think at the time, maybe we had 35,000 people on our Instagram. We had like 30,000 likes on this post, and it had been reshared. Like, I can't even tell you how many times, but most importantly, a large percentage of the vintners that we talked to were sold out of their vintages. And it just showcased for us like the power of our community. And I think for the first time, yeah. it was like the power is really with us in our community. The strength yeah. of community is so important.
You know, I'm right at this moment where we're talking, you cannot buy Black Girl Magic. It is sold out.
I'm the sister that's responsible for making things happen in a timely fashion, and we're actually bottling more today and for the next couple of weeks, so we will have some available for everyone very soon.
But it's a sign that suggests that you saw a spike in your business.
Oh, significant. And in May alone, we gained 8,000 new points of distribution.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, these places where you wouldn't expect to see wine being sold, and definitely at the price point in which Black Girl Magic is, it's nuts. You know, we have an awesome 7-Eleven in Texas that she was selling 3,000 bottles every 3 days.
Over the weekend.
Oh God.
For a $24 bottle of wine from 7-Eleven. She owns a 7-Eleven.
That's insane. I mean, I know that you guys, you know, don't talk about your financials, and I totally respect that. But is it fair to say you're selling many hundreds of thousands of cases of wine a year, or you're on track to do that?
That's fair. Yeah, that's accurate.
Wow. I mean, you guys have been grinding at this for 15 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, longer than that. But really, for 15 years, it's been a long journey. And you're now a significant player in the wine business in America.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
I know that throughout this interview, there are moments where you said, "Yay, we made it," you know, and you were kind of joking about it a little bit, but
yeah.
Can you say that now? Do you feel comfortable saying that?
I think honestly, the same optimism that we started out with when we had a palette of wine is very much what drives us today.
Yeah.
At the same time, we feel that we have a long way to go. You know, I think some people might give themselves a goal of a certain, you know, number of cases or a certain, you know, dollar revenue. But Andrea and I, we dream really big, and we always have.
Is your ultimate goal to have your own vineyards and your own grapes and your own production facility?
Yes.
Yep.
One of the things that we were looking at the beginning of this year and last year is still having a place for people to come and gather.
Like a tasting room.
Yeah, absolutely.
To experience wine, winemaking, vineyards, wine, you know, lifestyle, culture, all of those things, you need to have a welcoming place for people to come and spend that kind of time.
So that is part of the hope and dream, to find a plot of land where you can have some vineyards and a tasting room and a place where people can see how the wine is made.
Yeah, and also a training place as well. So if you're a woman, if you're a person of color that's interested in the grape growing, winemaking, or on the ownership side of the wine industry, this would be a place where you can come and feel welcome.
Yeah.
So it's like, we would love to see more women as head winemakers. We would love to see more women that are the head of like viticulture and grape growing. And then on the business of wine, executive leadership at distributors, making the purchasing decisions at retailers, you know, all throughout the business.
So here's something that is going to happen. In my experience on the show, interviewing, you know, hundreds of just entrepreneurs with different stories, you have already been, or you will be at some point, approached by a big company that wants to buy you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are in a very, very desirable market and growing very fast, and you've got a really strong brand. Is there a world where you could see an exit like that?
I can't call it. Like, in this moment, I'm very attached to my name.
Yeah.
I think I can never say, like, no one's ever come to me and Robin and said, "Here's a check for $500 million.
we don't know what that feels like.
But I mean, that could happen.
You know, no, I can't honestly sit here and say to you, knowing that that's intergenerational wealth, knowing just the basic principles of compounding interest at a very low interest rate, of what that will do for the legacy of our children, our grandchildren, our great, 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 and also philanthropically for the community that we want to support.
You can't rule that out.
Yeah. We can't rule it out. But I think that we can probably safely say, I mean, I think it's hard for us to envision one because our personal name is not for sale. So that's a little tricky. But also the brands that we create, you know, each of those brands has a very powerful message behind them. And like Andrea said, that don't belong to us necessarily. We see ourselves as the stewards of the purpose behind them. So if, you know, in any exit or any acquisition, you know, there would have to be some very stringent agreements behind that. I don't know that we can really think of any large wine companies that would be, you know, in a position to acquire what we think those are worth, that would be able to uphold the mission behind each of those brands. Not saying that it would happen, but I would probably say it wouldn't be now or anytime soon.
I can't stop thinking about your dad and what he would think about all of this. I mean, how you got to this place.
Yeah.
Because so much of the story is unbelievable. I mean, you didn't know the other sister existed. And then, you know, once you're both grown up, you eventually meet, and then you form this incredible bond. And now you've built this highly successful brand. I just have to imagine that your dad, if he was sitting here right now, he would just be blown away.
Well, quite honestly, and now I'm speaking as a sister who never actually got to know him at all, but from what I know of him, I don't think that he would have expected anything less from us. I think that he also dreamed very big. You know, he came from a very, very small, and I say small, like 500 people or something, country town in Alabama. You know, moved himself to Hollywood and became a part of that scene and an actor and, you know, and everything that was kind of wild going on in Hollywood in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, my understanding of him and my interpretation of him is that, you know, sky's the limit. Like you can and should do, you know, whatever you set your mind to. So in my mind, and I've thought about that before, in my mind, I don't think he'd be surprised. I think that if he was in our lives, he would have expected that we've done at least what we've done.
Yeah. And I think the context of our family, his family, of his generation, you know, Camden, Alabama, you know, our grandparents, our aunties and uncles, our father picked cotton. They're sharecroppers. You know, and I know in their lifetime, never thought that they would see a black president. I know that. So like Robin said, I think, you know, he dreamed really big, expected this of us. But I think the expectation also comes from all of our family in terms of what they did during the 60s and the 50s and all of the things that they fought for, so that Robin and I could do what we do today.
They must be so proud of you.
Oh, trust us. Auntie Annie Mae is very proud. You can't go to her house without her pulling out a magazine and telling you, well, let me tell you.
She will tell anybody who listens. Do not challenge her about her nieces. But it is very true. And our, you know, our aunts and uncles, our dad was the youngest of like 12, I think. So it's a very, very long generation. You know, they grew up in rural Alabama, just outside of Selma. So, you know, they walked, you know, the Edmund Pettus Bridge. They were involved in the civil rights, you know, demonstrations and movements. And we're not unaware of how close we are, you know, and how our roots are so intertwined with, you know, all of this history, and that we're not far from where all of it started. So,
And we're in agriculture.
We're back, you know, in agriculture.
Like, yeah. like the history of Black people in America is grounded in agriculture.
Andrea and I actually have a photo. We're able to go and visit the plantation house where our great grandparents were enslaved, and where our father was born, in the back, in the small house in the back. And I think that, you know, like his journey in life to move on from a lot of that difficult history was for the purpose of his children and Andrea and I being able to do something like exactly what we're doing.
how much of this story and the success of this business do you attribute to just your hard work and your intelligence, and how much do you think has to do with luck? First to you, Robin.
I would say 99% of it is our hard work and intelligence. And then there's a small percentage that I think is what people might refer to as luck. But I really think it is your ability to recognize opportunity and take advantage of it.
Same thing. I feel like it's hustle, it's hard work, but it's smart hard work. And it's being able to identify opportunities when other people don't or maybe can't see those opportunities.
They can't see it, yeah.
And then I think in terms of luck, I don't know if I believe in luck. I think you prepare yourself, you're ready. And then if an opportunity presents itself, then you're the right person, the right place at the right time.
Stay ready.
Yeah, stay ready.
That's Andrea McBride-John and her sister, Robin McBride. By the way, in addition to the McBride Sisters Collection and Black Girl Magic brand, Robin and Andrea have launched a third brand. It's a collection of 4 canned wines, a rosé, a Sauvignon Blanc, and a couple of spritzers. It's called She Can, and some of the money from sales goes back to a scholarship program for small businesses owned by Black women. Robin and Andrea say 2 of those wines are dedicated to their mothers, and the other 2 to their daughters. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to write to us, our email address is hibt@npr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're @HowIBuiltThis or @GuyRaz. And on Instagram, it's @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by Rachel Faulkner with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Liz Metzger, Dareth Gales, J.C. Howard, Julia Carney, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Farah Safari. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR.
Voting is crucial, and I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this a man?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Listen now.